You know, I was here a little less than 2 years ago, and kind of a lot of electoral water has gone over the dam. Unfortunately, sometimes I'm just astounded at where we are here today. Let me first say, though, that Stone Arch is a great institution. It's what makes great cities. Gatherings of people, the buildings are great, the trails are great and all that, but the gatherings in cities of people to share ideas and make things happen, that really is what great cities are about. And so this is one of the pieces that makes Minneapolis great. As I said, I didn't ever think we'd be in this pickle that we're in right now. We're going through the Great Recession. We got Jerry Brown and Andrew Cuomo talking about cutting Medicaid in their states. California and Illinois are essentially broke. We may have bottomed out on the economy, but it's going to take us a long time to kind of crawl out from under that. And I just didn't think this was possible. And what's really astounding to me, and I'm glad Larry Michel is coming to tell us how to win elections, because we've got one in another year here that's going to be pretty dang important. It's how it is that we've gotten ourselves in a situation where the people who mismanaged the economy and drove it off a cliff are now ascendant, and we're kind of on the defensive trying to react to that. I think it's very discouraging. I used to say that the Republicans were trying to take us back to William McKinley, past Nixon, past Herbert Hoover, certainly past Theodore Roosevelt, back to McKinley, but now they're actually, feels like they're trying to take us back to John C. Calhoun. Now, I know he's a Democrat, okay? He was a Democrat, but he was the beginning of the emerging Republican majority, I would contend. But that is where they're taking us. I mean, some of these ideas are just absolutely astounding. Nullification and states' rights and all that business that, in their states, California and Illinois are essentially broke. We may have bottomed out on the economy, but it's going to take us a long time to kind of crawl out from under that. And I just didn't think this was possible. And what's really astounding to me, and I'm glad Larry Michel is coming to tell us how to win elections, because we've got one in another year here that's going to be pretty dang important. It's how it is that we've gotten ourselves in a situation where the people who mismanaged the economy and drove it off a cliff are now ascendant, and we're kind of on the defensive trying to react to that. I think it's very discouraging. I used to say that the Republicans were trying to take us back to William McKinley, past Nixon, past Herbert Hoover, certainly past Theodore Roosevelt, back to McKinley, but now they're actually, feels like they're trying to take us back to John C. Calhoun. Now, I know he's a Democrat, okay? He was a Democrat, but he was the beginning of the emerging Republican majority, I would contend. But that is where they're taking us. I mean, some of these ideas are just absolutely astounding.
And Lincoln and slavery sort of superseded that sentiment. We had a tough election in 1938, and we had Franklin Roosevelt doing the court packing attempts. There was a lot of attempt to beat back the changes that Roosevelt was putting in place in the New Deal. Lyndon Johnson, signing the civil rights legislation, said we're doing a great thing here today, but he was predicted that we might be ushering in a new generation of Republican control of the United States. And some of that, a lot of that has actually come true. So the forces of regression have been in place in this country before, and that's what we're dealing with right now. So after that cheery little recitation, what's Hennepin County up to, okay? Now, I think we're still, we may be, one of the last ones standing. I mean, we truly believe on the county board and in the county organization, we believe that we can use government, public sector, as a source of good, a source for opportunity, and a source for creating a competitive economic future. That's really, we still believe that on the county board. Now, there's a this fundamental problem that we're fighting, though. And the fundamental problem has been that we've got economic growth has been happening. It's now stagnating. But most people haven't been sharing in the benefits of that economic growth for a generation. And the Republicans, frankly, starting in 66, and with Nixon's presidency, they've exploited this clash with the working class people that they don't feel like they're part of the growth, part of the prosperity. And so we've got to get back to some of those fundamentals. And that's why I've always believed, and this has been a little bit of a change in the role for Hennepin County, it's important that we provide the services. We're paying attention to that, whether it's healthcare, social services, the like. But there's also, I believe we've got to be contributing to a vision of economic growth and real strategies for growth in this region, keeping this region competitive, and giving people entree to share in the benefits of that economic growth. It's a complicated deal in this with the globalized economy, but that's what we believe in at the county board, and that's what I want to talk about, some of the things that we're doing to do that. And I'll just, one last little downer here. You know, if you think about the county board, we've got reapportionment coming. We've got Randy Johnson, who is one of the old-fashioned Republicans out of Bloomington. Neil Peterson, another one, former mayor, lost his legislative seat to a challenge. Randy's the longest-serving county commissioner in the history of the county. At some point, he'll retire, I guess, he says. So, I mean, that's a seat that's vulnerable. The Jan Callison seat has flipped a few times in the past to a more conservative bent. The OPAT seat with reapportionment, that could go in a different direction too. So this is the elections at the county level are going to be potentially important in the future as well. So we're paying attention to that. But we're still committed to this. We don't have an identity crisis on the county board right now. We think we understand what we need to do. But the other thing we believe in is we believe in government that actually works. And that's one of the things that we've got to do is have a government that works so that we can hold up to people and say, look, yes, we're taking your tax dollars, but with your tax dollars, we're doing this, this, and this. This is how we're doing it, and we're being efficient and effective in what we do. That is the requirement right now. To continue to garner the public support. And I think we've done okay on that. And we're going to continue to pay attention to that and be tough-minded about it. A couple years ago when I was here, I talked about how the county had kind of filled in the void that was created by other governmental units sort of shrinking back on transit, on libraries, and even the ballpark. Those were not functions that the county performed in the past. I think that's probably going to continue in light of where the tax base is, where the financial capacity is, unless they bankrupt us. That's the other strategy that's going on here. They're doing it at the federal level, create a financial crisis. Oh, yeah, tax cuts for the super rich. 1 month later, oh, my God, there's a big deficit. We got to do something about that. So, I mean, they're going to try to do that at the state level as well. They're going to cut down on aid to cities. They're going to cut back on aid to counties, and then we're not going to have the financial capacity to do things. They screwed up the property tax about 10 years ago under Ventura and put more of the burden on modest valued homes. That makes it more difficult to use and more unfair to use the property tax. So they've got some mechanisms in place here. So we're going to have to deal with those things. Having said that again, I think if you go back, you know, the sort of golden era of Hennepin County reform was under Stan Cowell. Many of you remember Stan, first county administrator. That was the year where there was an era there when the county took over operations of the city jail, took over operations of Minneapolis General Hospital, built the crosstown, the first county freeway in the United States of America. There was a period of activism, and there were structural changes in how Hennepin County worked there, getting rid of the election of the treasurer and the auditor, and some should have gotten rid of election of the sheriff, too, but that's another matter, which is archaic as the rest of them. But that happened in that era, and I think we're kind of in another era here in which the county is stepping up and playing a major role and that the that we're going to continue to try to do just that. Let's talk. I want to kind of do a run through of some of the issues that the county's been dealing with, and there are a lot of them, and they're right in the center, I think, of what the issues are going to be that are going to determine the future. Let's start with healthcare. The legislature last year provided, as everyone knows, the chance for this state to get in for 15 days for the new governor. And by virtue of 8,700 votes, our new governor was able to do that. And so we're now going to be an early entrant into the new healthcare reform at the federal level. There was also a provision for the county or counties to actually make an application to get a waiver and to participate in some innovative programs at the federal level under the new healthcare reform and do that early. We are preparing to do that. Last year, the state cut general assistance medical care, as you know, and they gave us essentially 30 cents on the dollar to take care of that same group of patients in Hennepin County. They didn't go away. They gave us 30 cents on the dollar. We actually created a new way of managing the care of that population, which had to do with trying to actually guide the individuals to clinics. And we set up a special clinic for some of the heaviest users. It's a kind of one of those classic 80-20 populations where 20% are using 80% of the services. So we actually identified a special clinic that we're guiding those individuals into, because there's a high incidence of mental health, chemical dependency, high use of emergency rooms and all that. And so we're trying to get to a medical home, which is one of the key tenets of the new healthcare reform, an actual place, non-emergency room place where people get their healthcare. So for this very difficult, very expensive population, we set up special clinics and special management techniques that included not only doctors and nurses, but also some social workers and others to help guide them in their treatment. And what we did, it was pretty astounding what we did. We actually flipped emergency room use and clinic use. They had high use of emergency room before and virtually no use of clinics, and we flipped that. And we saved a considerable amount of money. Having said that, you know, we used to get over $90 million to take care of that group of patients. Under Pawlenty, we got about $30 million. We didn't save $60 million, okay? So there's still pressure, and we're hoping that we can replicate this model and use it as the basis for better treatment for that group of individuals, lower cost treatment of that group of individuals as a part of the new healthcare reform. And so we're trying to put that in place. We had Dave Durenberger come in, and we had a conversation with him, and he said, don't wait for somebody else to do healthcare reform or give you permission to do it. Create your own set up here. You've got the chance to create one of the new, modern, cutting-edge healthcare systems in the whole country, because you've got a hospital, high-quality teaching hospital, clinics that you own, clinics that you fund, an HMO, and you've got a highly motivated group of doctors. Now, you've got all the pieces that you need, plus the social services that are so critical to a true healthcare reform. Now, we're moving on that. It's difficult. We've got the doctors group, we hire them on a contract at the medical center. That's a vestige of the 80s. And it creates some problems because you can't align their incentives with the incentives of the hospital because of self-referrals and things like that. So we're trying to bring them into our system. The issue is going to be one pot of money. It's got to be shared across the social workers, the doctors, the nurses, the hospital, the clinics. And as you might expect, there's a little shoving and pushing here about who gets how much of the money. So we're trying to figure out a way to do that. But we think that it's in many ways back to the original vision for HMOs. Jobs and equity with transit all in one package here, trying to knit them together. And we were one of only three regions in the country that received the maximum federal grant, $5 million, to do planning to help make that happen. What that means is we're talking about development and land use controls that will encourage development and jobs around the transit stops, so that we can connect people efficiently and effectively. The interchange, that's being passed around now. That'll be one right here at the ballpark. That'll be where four LRT lines come together. North Star comes in there. There are 1,900 bus operations a day today right there. So we're trying to bring all those things together. If you've been to Washington, it's like Metro Center plus buses. So you've got a lot of synergy and a lot of effective transportation there. Now, the idea of this, though, is to actually create the big idea at the federal level, and what we're trying to replicate here is kind of an alternative to Levittown. Remember those Look magazine pictures, the suburbanization of America? And that was what we lived through for the last 40, 50 years. We're trying to see if we can start to create a different vision for urban America that uses the transit investments coupled with land use controls and other investments to provide a different pattern of development in our regions, better access to jobs. And if you think, I mean, one of the things about Levittown was that was about exclusion. The restrictive covenants and the like, that was to keep people of color, poor people, out. Now, the vision that we're trying to embrace here is one where we include people of color, low-income people, in the economic growth of the region and design a region that actually works for them. That's the, in terms of big vision, that's what we're trying to do there. So we continue the sales tax, just a quick update on the sales tax. The County Transit Improvement Board was the five counties. It's a joint powers board. Created in 5.5 weeks after the veto of the transportation bill, we have distributed $317 million in investments in transit in less than 3 years. And so the Central Corridor would not be built without it. Southwest wouldn't be possible without that. And we've had unanimous votes. And we had a vote in Washington County. It was a 3-2 vote to stay in the county's Transit Improvement Board. And there was one vote from somebody on that county board who originally voted against the sales tax, and another vote from a woman who campaigned against it. It was one of the cores of her campaign. But they're now voting for it because they see that the vision for the region moving forward and that they're part of it. So I think we've made great progress. The grim side is this the governor of Wisconsin. He's a hero to the Republican legislators, I will tell you. He just sent back $800 and some million to Washington because he didn't want a high-speed rail connection from Chicago to Madison. Now, I mean, that's a triumph of ideology over pragmatism, it seems to me. There was going to be a factory that manufactured rail cars in Wisconsin, too. That was a part of one of the side deals that he threw away. So it's really too, I mean, when I say pragmatism, it would have been an easy deal to blame Governor Doyle, the former Democratic governor, for all, you know, all these commitments that he made. But, oh, all right, we'll build it to Madison, but not an inch past Madison. I mean, that was the easy political solution. But ideology triumphed over that. And we're the worst for it because it's got to get to Madison if it's going to get here. So that's a setback. And what's going on at the legislature is they're trying to mush together passenger rail and light rail and make it one, you know, it's just trains and we're against, you know, trains. And what they're trying to say is we have enough money to fund the needs of the state of Minnesota, but not the wants, the baubles, the add-ons. And they're trying to put trains, all trains, into that category. So we're back to fundamental arguments on Southwest. We're saying, look, we've done the analysis. That's the best investment for that corridor. Not necessarily the best for every corridor, and we understand that. But so we're back to, you know, where it was in the late 80s, early 90s. The passenger rail stuff, I think we're in a little bit of a holding pattern, unfortunately, on that one. So, but I think, you know, we still have the opportunity here to move this thing forward in this region. The question is, by passenger rail, do I mean like regular trains like North Star? North Star is actually commuter rail. That's commuter rail. That just runs, that's a work-oriented train. It runs five times in the morning in five times in the evening out, and then one reverse train. That's different and distinct and has a different funding source than the passenger rail. Passenger rail is meant for cities. The goal is to try to connect cities of that are 500 miles or less apart with modern higher speed passenger rail. So this would be Chicago to Milwaukee to Madison to the Twin Cities. And so that's the distinction. Cities would pay off the principal on these things. And so his plan is an ambitious one. They've got 12 lines that they want to build in Los Angeles. It was going to take 30 years to build it. They've got a $40 billion revenue stream with an existing tax. The federal government said, issue the debt, provide some credit enhancements, write down the interest rate, we'll pay off the principal. They think they can build this thing within 10 years. So the idea here, they think they can speed it up, they can do more lines. This is a little bit akin to the Lyndon Johnson's problem with guns and butter when he changed the federal housing subsidies. That was on a more of a pay-as-you-go basis until the Section 8 came in. With Section 8, he could stretch out the payments. Walter Heller kind of winked at that one, as I recall, from my TA days. But that kind of stretched out the payments, and so they could continue to invest in housing, affordable housing, at high volumes. And that's what needs to happen at the on the transit issue, because there's so many corridors around the country that need to be built. The federal government obviously has financial problems. So I think there's some hope that this might happen, and we're in discussions with people about becoming one of the pilot regions across the country that would do something similar to this. So that would allow us to build out some of those lines on that map faster than we might otherwise be able to do that. In education, you're all familiar with the data on graduation rates. And you know the debate about whether it's a school failure or a family failure and whether there ought to be school reform and the like. What the county has taken a little narrower view of this. The option decided not to get plunged into the school reform debate. But many of the kids who aren't graduating are either enrolled in one of our programs already, or their families are in some way touched by the county. And so what we're saying is we need to build an educational component into our contacts with those kids and or those families. And that would be to encourage graduation, higher graduation rates. Mayor Michael Nutter of Philadelphia, in one of his early speeches, went out and he had three goals. One was to deal with crime. Another was to increase the rate of college graduates in the city of Philadelphia because they have so many colleges. And the third was to increase the high school graduation rate. And his chief aide took him aside afterwards in the back and he said, "Nice going, Mayor. You just committed to two of three things over which you have no control whatsoever." So he said, "Yeah, that's right, but it's darn important about, you know, for the future of the city." And so, you know, we think we have clear standing in terms of the juvenile justice services, the social services that we provide to the families when the kids are having troubles. And so it's a little harder than in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a joint city-county government. We've got 17 cities in our county. I'm sorry, 17 school districts in our county. The school district lines in Philadelphia are coterminous with the city as well. And in fact, they're under receivership, and so the mayor and the governor actually appoint the school board. So it's a little different situation. So we're trying to figure out how we structure something here, and we've been working with the superintendents to see if we can come up with an approach here that works. And the idea that they used in Philadelphia was to identify subgroups of kids who are not graduating at acceptable rates, and start figuring out strategies for those, whether it's kids who are in the juvenile justice system or they've been in out-of-home placement at some point in their life or others. And so then they try to tailor strategies. They call it multiple pathways to graduation. And they try to construct these different options. We've got some of the programming in place now. We're going to try to see where the holes are, where the kids are who are falling through the cracks, and try to boost the graduation rate over time. The mayor was clear in my conversation with him that you've got to have this is something you got to be into for the long haul. Doesn't happen quickly, and so he's committed to that. They're measuring it regularly, and they're making some significant progress in Philadelphia. I have to say, I still haven't figured out how to get the resources for early childhood that we need to, as one component of that, but we're continuing to work on that. Let me talk about a couple other things where technology comes into play, because that is one of the things that can actually be an engine for change and also for some efficiency. And I'm going to talk about a couple criminal justice things that we're working on. 911, dispatch, essential service. Everybody in the county depends on it. We've got also some evolving public safety needs, as if you've got people fleeing a crime, they're crossing different jurisdictions, you want to make sure that the dispatch is linked up. And you've got to have backup for these systems, because if one goes down, you've got to have somebody who can take over. So we've got nine different, they call them PSAPs, nine different places that actually do dispatching in the county. And they break out, essentially, the Minneapolis does about a third of the dispatches in the county. Hennepin County Sheriff does about a third. And then the other seven PSAPs do the other third. So it's a mixed system. Their protocols aren't the same. And you've got some problems that essentially two-thirds of the cities are in the sheriff's system. And the sheriff is independently elected, and he likes to remind the county board of that, I would tell you. But two-thirds of the people in the county live in places that have independent PSAPs, and therefore they're paying twice. Their taxpayers are paying twice. They're paying for the county system, and they're paying for their own individual system. So Minneapolis taxpayers are paying twice for dispatch. So happens the sheriff does need a new dispatch facility. So I consider that an opportunity to try to see if we can maybe get a reform going, effort going. And so I essentially held that up until the sheriff committed to actually participating in a discussion of how we kind of mesh these systems together. And there are really two models that you can go to. One is single dispatch under the sheriff. Now, even the sheriff doesn't want to do that immediately because he can't swallow Minneapolis. He wouldn't mind taking over the rest of the county. The cities aren't all that interested in that. But in his mind, that was the long-term vision. The other is a kind of new network system using technology where you've got three or four maybe major systems networked together, similar protocols, and they become a kind of virtual system, and you have a governance structure over all of that to make sure that everybody gets high-quality service, the protocols are acceptable, and there's a fair distribution of costs. That's what we're going to take a look at right now. We're going to take a look at both those models, but that's the direction that I'm pushing this thing. There's a chance to make that happen. There's a lot of history here that's a little difficult, but I think, again, the technology now allows for this kind of networking, and I think that the financial pressures are going to be such that there's some room to make some improvements. And you can, frankly, finesse some of the labor issues, because you've got different labor organizations doing dispatch in different jurisdictions. And if you do this network system, you can kind of sidestep some of those problems. So we've got great consultants on board. They've done work in Boston and New York. I've talked to them. And if you can do work in Boston and New York on this kind of thing, I mean, it's not about cities working with cities. That's the fire department working with the police department in those two places, I will tell you. So these guys are pretty smart, pretty savvy, and I'm hoping we can make some progress there. We've got a similar thing with the crime lab. The crime lab is, you know, we all watch CSI. There's this growing need for crime lab services, even though that's a little overstated on that show. We all know that. But in fact, we've got an aging infrastructure, and we've got a lot of inefficiencies, frankly. There are things that the city specializes in. The city's got a crime lab. The county's got a crime lab. So you're paying twice again. Only this time you're paying three times because the state's got a crime lab. Okay, so city taxpayers pay three times for crime labs. We're trying to figure out how you, again, meshed these together. There was a task force that issued a report a little while ago that said there ought to be a one regional countywide crime lab, and that we've got to figure out how to do that. It might take, the study said, up to 5 years. We need an interim structure to kind of pick out the specializations that the city can handle and that the county can handle, and try to move again toward a single system for crime lab services that's going to save resources, get quicker service for this service that there's a great demand for. That's going to be an interesting little debate too. And I will say, you know, all of these things take an enormous amount of energy and hand-holding, arm-twisting, depending on which week it is. And so that's kind of how it goes. But there is, again, great potential there for better service using the technology as an engine, and I think we can move forward. Solid waste. I call this one why liberals get a bad name. We, in Hennepin County, we're awash in garbage. We have 1.5 million tons a year of garbage in Hennepin County. That's over a ton, over 2,000 pounds a person. Okay? A third of it now goes to landfills, which has been judged to be an inferior way to handle it, and you end up with problems over time with leakage and the like. So 500,000 tons a year. Recycling has essentially plateaued. That's a function of partly the economy, but it had plateaued before the economy went in the tank, partly because the newspapers are thinner paper, smaller paper, the plastic containers that you use are thinner, and there are things like that. And the systems have essentially plateaued in terms of what they can go out and efficiently collect to a point. Beyond that, the financial and legal underpinnings of our garbage system that we put in place before my time, in the late 80s, early 90s, which was that the counties could control the garbage and say that all the garbage has to go through their facilities, and the county set the fee that was charged for that. That was judged to be an interference in interstate commerce, that garbage was a commodity in interstate commerce. Well, the Supreme Court of the United States didn't think so, unfortunately. And so it essentially, after there were a bunch of investments made using that business model, the court said you couldn't do that. And so essentially we were competing with landfills in Spirit Lake, Iowa, in Wisconsin, and they were cheaper. They were a whole heck of a lot cheaper than actually combusting the garbage or handling it doing high levels of recycling and the like. So we've been in a problem situation for a while. We also, at Hennepin County, we had our contracts that were, we had long-term contracts where we had to deliver a certain amount of garbage. We had debts that we had to pay off. A lot of that stuff now we're done with it. We now own the garbage burner, free and clear, or will in another couple of months. And so there are some resources that could be put together. In addition to that, though, and this is where we get into why liberals get a bad name, I think. The garbage burner, the HERC, the Hennepin Energy Resource Recovery Center, could process 11% more garbage than it does right now. It has the physical capacity to do that. You have to get a conditional use permit from the city of Minneapolis, and that has become a highly politicized issue to increase the throughput at the garbage burner by 11%. Now, the argument is this. It's virtually no cost. We have made some investments recently to actually make it more efficient. We're actually not only producing electricity enough for 25,000 houses, but we're providing heat into the downtown district heating system with the waste energy that used to be going out of the stack. So it's producing energy in a cost-effective way, and it's cleaner than coal. It's way cleaner than coal. I've had a few meetings with people, and I've asked that the lights be turned off and the computers be turned off because, you know, we do need electricity, and that's what we're talking about here, is producing electricity. But that wasn't well received when I suggested that. But So here's the proposal. Our proposal is to get the permit for an 11% increase in the throughput. We'll produce more electricity, more steam heat. We're going to, and it's virtually cost-free because the plant can handle it. And we'll save transport costs, get more trucks that can just drive right there rather than having to have the garbage shipped to Iowa or someplace else. So then what we're looking at is an ounce-for-ounce offset to any pollution that gets produced. If you look at coal production versus this, virtually all of the pollutants, there's less pollution being caused by burning the garbage at the burner than having coal produced electricity. There are a couple exceptions to that. One is NOx, nitrogen oxide. We have a technological fix to that. We're prepared to invest over $1 million to reduce the amount of NOx that gets emitted. We can actually take the NOx that's produced down below the levels that are being produced now, even though we'd be shoving 11% more garbage through the plant. There's a carbon monoxide problem, a little bit. We can't quite offset that. We're prepared to retrofit our fleet and whatever it takes in other fleets that are operating here of diesel trucks, and we can reduce that more than is produced with this extra increment. And we're working on special offsets for dioxins, which is the toughest one of all. So this would produce $1.5 million in net new revenue because of the energy that we would produce. We would then commit to invest that into innovative recycling or composting activities. We think that's a good package. That's good for the environment. It's good for taxpayers, and it's good for our long-term sustainable future. Yes. Most of the lead in the ground is left over from cars when there was leaded gasoline. Most of the mercury, we put in mercury scrubbers on the garbage burner early in my tenure on the board, and I insisted on it, that dropped the amount of mercury coming out of the burner by over 90%. We, in terms of all the standards, we're way, way down in terms of we're meeting them by a big margin. The one exception to that is the nitrogen oxide, and the new technology will drop that down. So that's one argument that gets made. I think it's not, we're going to be, again, we're ready to do this ounce for ounce trade-off, and we think that's a good trade-off for everybody. Beyond that, we're ready to embark on some of these other activities that are going to be better for handling the garbage as well. The other argument that gets raised is, well, if you do this, then you're not going to do composting or recycling. You're going to have to feed the garbage burner. We're talking about 2.6% of all the garbage generated in Hennepin County. We're talking about it's about 8%, I think, of composting project. Hennepin County actually invested in that with some of the funds that we would have, and that's how the $1.5 million could be used. We're doing a different kind of experiment in Seward now that we're financing, and it has shown some promise. But in Linden Hills, there are limits to what you can get. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make, or you can lead a herd of horses to water, but you can't make them all drink. In Linden Hills, fewer than 50% of the people are participating in a free composting program where you have to put the compost out. Okay, so there are limits to that. And so I think it's a good effort. I think there are places where it could be applied some more, and I think we need to do some experimenting to see what exactly will elicit the greatest level of participation. You need to know, you know, some people say, I mean, Minneapolis is in the lower, and this is what kind of galls the county board a little bit. We get to get lectured by the city people when the city's recycling rate per household is in the lower quartile among the cities in the county. And if you look at, and so then there's the argument, well, there's fewer people, there's da da da. Well, there's something to be said about that. More multifamily units, there's something to be said about that. But if you look at what's left, what actually gets thrown in the garbage can, only 44% of the stuff in the garbage can could be recycled. That's it. There's still, the city is only capturing 44% of the recyclable materials among all of the people here. So there's, if you compare that to Minnetonka, they capture 82% of the recyclable stuff in the recycling stream. St. Louis Park does 81%. So, and Minneapolis has got the most complicated, maybe in the Western Hemisphere, recycling system, you know, all the bins and all that. And there's evidence that shows that you get higher levels of participation if you can simplify that a little bit. So we're trying that experiment down in Seward. So we think there's room here for improvement. And frankly, Minneapolis has been a drag on our recycling rate for a long time. And so we think we can raise that up. We can work with the city. One of the ideas that's been proposed, and we're, you know, our county is still in the upper tier in terms of handling of garbage compared to regions around the country. We're not in the very top. There's one other layer above us, and it's what? San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, places like that. The difference in their systems is they actually have a mandate that says residents must recycle or businesses must recycle. And we've been through, that was a classic debate before my time on the county board. The other option is to put a mandate on that says that large generators of compostable material have to put it out in a bin for it to be composted. That would be a business or a school or something like that, a restaurant or a school. That's something to be discussed, and maybe we try and experiment in Minneapolis if as a part of this to see how that would work. So that's what we're looking at. But we're at a point here, we've plateaued out, we understand that, we need to do better. We think that the expansion of the throughput at the garbage burner is a tiny increase that could actually help capitalize other innovations that could actually move us from a high tier to the highest tier among regions around the country and produce some energy to boot. Met Council. Perennial reform or issue. There's a discussion, the Office of Legislative Auditor looking at transit governance concluded that there it would be a good idea to have local elected officials permitted to serve on the Metropolitan Council. Now, our two former members here will have a nice discussion about that. It's an interesting debate, I think. Frankly, the funding of transit is probably more central where more energy ought to go this year. But on the question of governance, the two models are, the traditional model has been have the membership be individuals who are one step removed from the fray, one step removed from the local decisions, one step removed from parochial interests. That's the theory. And then the other side is, okay, we've changed a little bit here, and the nature of what the Met Council needs to do would benefit from having some local elected officials on it as members. Now, right now, there's a Supreme Court decision that says there's a conflict between the role of a local official and the role of Met Council. It doesn't speak specifically to Met Council, but it's a decision about conflict in positions, in the roles of the two positions, in which case you can't serve in the two positions. And that's why local elected officials have not historically been appointed to the Metropolitan Council. So this is going to be a debate that may come up. The legislative auditor has issued a report that suggests that it would help to have local elected officials serving on the Metropolitan Council. The other notion, of course, the third option is just independently elected Metropolitan Council members, which is the third option. So we can have that discussion here. Let me, how are we doing on time here? It must be about time here. Okay. We have a number of other issues that we're working on in terms of how we work with the community, how we try to provide these services. We're working with the Network for Better Futures to take ex-offenders and put them into jobs, and we actually have them doing some jobs related to solid waste as a way to move them back in. We're doing all sorts of administrative streamlining. We run smack into the state bureaucracy pretty fast when we do some of those things, but we're working on that. We're trying to do better out-of-home placement purchasing. We've got a co-parenting court. We're working on an exit strategy for kids coming out of a court order to a shelter placement, but they don't have a social worker, and so they've just been kind of dropped back into a bad situation, so we're trying to work with those families. So we've got a lot of things that are on our plate here. All of these take an enormous amount of energy to move forward. Let me just go back to my original theme here. We're committed to playing an active role in making this community better, giving people more opportunity, and providing governmental services in an efficient, effective way. I think our board is willing to take on tough issues and put the time and energy in to make it happen. I think the library consolidation, those are tough issues. I still think, on balance, that was a big, big step forward and that has really served the community well. But the unifying themes here are, one, there are financial pressures across units of government. We've got to do better with the money we have. Systems, there's a lot of inefficiencies. There are inequities in the financing that we need to be looking at. There are some technological fixes, if we can put those in place, that can make a big difference. We've got to deal with the governance questions. Those are always thorny, but that's something I think this county board is ready to take on and in a strategic way to make some changes happen. Finally, I just would close. In some ways, the social contract in this state is close to breaking or broken. I mean, if you think about what happened in the last election with the business investment and some of the campaigns and the like, I mean, it's a different deal than we have had traditionally. And I think there needs to be some pretty tough conversations with some of the business leadership about what the heck you really want here. I think they've been, some of the leaders have been looking the other way. Some have been a little cavalier, and others are pursuing their conservative agenda. But the contract that we've had here, that it's allowed for high levels of cooperation between business and the public sector, I think is close to broken, if not broken. And I think that needs to be addressed directly, or we're not going to be able to be the kind of state that we want to be. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. Aviva. I took that out of the hospital's request for, they wanted to support that. I think moving it from like every 3 years to every five or something like that. We're not for the repeal. Okay. And I took that out to make sure. It was proposed by the hospital board and we took it out. I took it out specifically. Yes. I'm sorry, the question was, what's our position on the repeal of pay equity? And it was proposed by our hospital board to be part of our legislative program, and I didn't move the resolution. I took it out of the resolution that they wanted. The city has to issue a conditional use permit. And their conditional use permit says there can be 360,000 tons per year, or 370,000 tons per year. And so the city would have to take an action to change the conditional use permit. Well, there's the environmental assessment worksheet is being finalized right now, and I think within the next 6 months it'll be before the city council. So when the time comes, we'll get the word out. If people want to weigh in on that, that would be great. But it's within the next 6 months, it's going to be teed up. The almost billion dollar budget bill, the cut that the Republicans passed and the Governor Dayton rejected, included substantial cuts, additional cuts in local government aid on top of those that have been made in the last few years. We'll see what Governor Dayton, the starting position on the debate will come from Governor Dayton. He's been much more supportive in his comments of local government aid. It's very important. If Hennepin County ends up, if not bankrupt, financially strapped and having to go to the property tax to pay for the investments that we need to make, it's going to be harder to do it. So we need that revenue stream. And essentially, local government aid is using broad-based statewide taxes to make to deal with the burden of municipal and county services. And that's important. A lot of the county services actually are done at the behest of the state. And we're an administrative arm. And so that's a way of supporting those activities as well. So it's a big deal. It's going to be about property taxes and about the ability to keep things off of the property tax. It is complicated. There's no question about that. And it varies from program to program. But for the most part, healthcare, social services, that's the door you want to go through is a county door. The county is the administrative arm for the state, though they've been moving now to the state issuance of some of the checks rather than the individual counties issuing checks, for example. But the county would be the place to go for social services and healthcare. And if that's not the right door, we'll try to direct them to the right place.